orange. And now you can plot the distribution of droplet size coming out of that nozzle. In other words, it's a kind of a Gaussian-shaped curve where the vertical axis is probability, the horizontal axis is how big are the droplets. There's a Gaussian distribution. If you plug in the right amount of air, the right amount of air-fuel mixture, so that you're right in the middle of that Gaussian curve, the good news is you're getting the maximum temperature out of the plane. That isn't good. Sounds good, it ain't good. Because the larger droplets aren't getting enough air to fully burn, therefore they're making soot. You now put in a much higher amount of air, so you make sure that the big droplets get burned. The good news is you're now burning up all of the droplets, so to speak, and you're no longer making soot. The bad news is you're pumping in a hell of a lot more air, and therefore you're getting a slightly colder flame. I'd rather do that, by the way, because now I'm making sure I'm not making carbon monoxide, and I'm not making a whole lot of black soot in my whole system. And the black soot on your boiler, by the way, is an extremely good insulator. As such, the heat of your flame is no longer being coupled to the boiler. Let me drop. When you go to the 140 or 150 pounds per square inch, all of those droplets become a hell of a lot finer, and the distribution becomes smaller. In other words, instead of a great big wide Gaussian curve, you've now got a finer curve of very fine droplets, and it's much easier to set the fuel-air mixture to get a nice clean flame. As such, ordinarily, the average person is getting his burner serviced every single year, and the service person is taking out a ton of soot out of the burner, out of the flue, out of the flue pipes, and everything. All this black soot. That black soot is improperly burned oil. When you have a proper burning of the oil, the little bit of sand and dirt that might be in the oil, what's the right I'm looking for now? Silicon? Not the right word. Minerals. The oil does contain some minerals that do not burn, that can't be filtered out. As such, when they come out of the flame and they coat themselves onto the flue pipes, it is a tan-colored soot, so to speak. Very little of it. I don't have to clean my furnace. I clean my furnace once every 3 or 4 years, whether it needs it or not, so to speak. And I can get away with that because I'm getting such a clean fire. When Erwin Dresner, K2TRP, who's now a silent key, had his, a contract from Brookhaven Laboratories to inspect the quality of the oil burners that are in the domestic homes on Long Island. Let me drop. He found out a very high percentage of them were running an extremely rich fuel-to-air mixture, getting incomplete combustion. And there's three disadvantages of that. Number one, you're not really burning the oil. Number two, you're dumping a whole lot of soot into the environment and soot into your flue pipes and onto your boiler. Number three, I mentioned already, carbon monoxide is present. You really don't have to have that. And number four, because you're not completely burning the oil, you're burning more oil than you have to. And if you think about it, the guy who does the service for you, there's a conflict of interest. If he adjusts the fuel-air mixture so that you're burning more oil per air, so to speak, he sells you more oil. Think about that. There's a conflict of interest. So that almost everybody, the guy who does the service is the same guy that's adjusting your burner and the same guy that's cleaning it. The cleaning is nowhere near as required if you get the right burn. And what I discovered is that many of the burners, when you open up the vanes that will control the amount of air going in, and you open them all the way, it give you enough air. You only get the right amount of air if you cut back the number of gallons per hour. The majority of furnaces are set with much higher a number of gallons per hour than's really needed. There's three disadvantages of that. Let me drop. Number one, you don't have the ability to give it enough air. Number two, the fire is a very noisy, roaring fire. And number three, your burner is now running very intermittently, short bursts. You get a much more efficient burn when you run the furnace for a longer period of time. The people who set up oil burners are scared to death that the day is going to happen of a minus 10 degree day and the burner running continuously and the house only gets up to 65 degrees Fahrenheit and they're afraid of being sued. That's such an extremely rare event, that whole scenario that they tell you as an excuse for what they're doing. doesn't hold water. When you cut back, my furnace arrived at, I think it was either 9/10 or 1 gallon per hour nozzle, and I'm using now 6/10, I think, on my furnace for the house, and I think it's 0.45 gallons per hour for the hot water heater. As such, I'm getting a much more efficient burn. It runs a little bit longer. I will admit that the one day per 5 years in which the temperature outside goes down to minus 10 degrees, because I'm using a smaller number of gallons per hour, maybe my house will only get up to 65 degrees. Well, my family owns ski jackets. That's such a rare event, and we know ahead of time. I wouldn't, and by the way, I own a couple of extra nozzles. On that particular rare event, on that particular day, I'd go down there and go to a larger nozzle for that particular day. But for the rest of the time, I'm getting a much more efficient burn, much cleaner burn, and using less oil. After I made all of these modifications, the number of gallons per year that I used to burn versus now changed considerably, and it's the exact same furnace, if you know what I mean. So from my point of view, for we amateur operators who have got the gumption to be able to open up the case of a radio and change the fuse and check on the power supply and stuff like that, let me drop. If you're a guy that's not afraid of violating the guarantee, so to speak, from the company that built your radio. If you're not worried about breaking the seal and voiding the guarantee on your radio, by the same token, oil burner service is not rocket science. I mean, just like in the case of servicing an automobile, if the engine doesn't run, what do? You find out, does it have spark? Does it have fuel flowing into the carburetor? Back in the days, we had a carburetor. If it's got fuel, it's got spark, it's got to run, as long as you've got some compression, so to speak. And the engine will turn over. And the same thing with an oil burner. Is the oil flowing in, and the gauge is showing that the oil is flowing? Can I look through the little observation hole and see the mist? Are the igniters making a spark? If you've got oil flow and if you've got spark, it's got to run, as long as the igniter's in the right spot. So it's not rocket science, and it gives me a feeling of confidence that I can. It's not one of these mysterious machines in my basement that I'm at the mercy of everyone else that's going to maintain it for me to keep my house warm. That's my attitude. So not everybody agrees, and a lot of people. Let me drop. A lot of people don't want to touch that system because they think it smells bad and it's dirty. Well. Yes, it will be dirty if you got a whole lot of soot, black soot, and you have a whole lot of black soot if you have an improper burning system. When you've got a proper burning system, there ain't no black soot. Yeah, you're still going to get some oil on your fingers when you open up those pipes to change the nozzle. And Sid Harvey will sell you a cleaning fluid that you can wash your hands with that'll get rid of the smell of the oil if that's what bothers you. So it's not dirty work, and it gives me confidence to be able to maintain that system. And now I know how well it's working. I've made other changes, but anybody with any questions on all of this, give me a call that is right now. K2RIW in the TechNet. Okay. You know, about once every 6 months, we do discuss oil burners. Yes, it does sound like a non-ham radio thing. But we amateurs who are willing to put up an antenna, willing to install transmission lines, willing to make modifications to your radio, willing to repair your radio, you develop a certain kind of confidence of being able to maintain the stuff that you own. And a very important thing in my house happens to be the refrigerator and the oil burner. And to some degree, I can maintain the refrigerator, and to a considerable degree, I can maintain the oil burner. I'm willing to change the oil filters in my automobile. I'm willing to change a battery. I'm willing to change a radiator. I'm not willing to change a transmission. That's a little bit too far. I mean, some of my very enthusiastic engineering friends will rebuild an automatic transmission. That's a little bit too far for me. And that same guy, by the way, thinks nothing about rebuilding an engine and an automobile. And that's too much for me. But rotating the tires, changing... I'm not sure I would change an oil pump today. I'm not sure I would change a timing belt today. On many automobiles, that's a little bit too elaborate. But the radiator, the battery... air filters, things like this, I'm willing to, and light bulbs, I'm willing to change those things on an oil burner. So I like doing a certain kind of maintenance, and my oil burner happens to be one of those. Okay, I think you got guys have had enough of that one. Let's see what Rich has got to say tonight. N2EO, how are the guys in Massapequa treating you tonight, Rich? K2RIW in the TechNet. Okay, Dick, K2RIW, TechNet, Limo. Well, first of all, I'll bring this up. When I lived in Whitestone, Queens, I did my own oil burner servicing. And just what you're saying, there was no soot. It would come out after a year with a tan coloring on the inside of the fuel pipes. Exactly apropos to what you're talking about. And, Dick, my question is this. I've been considering, well, I got some money coming in probably this coming week. And I've been considering the Kenwood
Bridge,
you know, which covers 160 meters to 10 meters plus 6 plus 2 meters plus 440. I know John, KCWGB has that radio. Barry N2MB has it. A lot of people have that radio. But I'm also now considering the Kenwood TS590, which covers 160 to 6. No 2, no 440. Has roofing filters that has a lot more stuff in it for HF. The price is about the same. The 590 is a couple hundred dollars more than the 2000. Not a big difference. I'm wondering if there's anybody out there who's compared the two side by side or who owns a TS590. I'd like to get their opinion. Back to net and to EO.
Okay, so anybody with opinions on the comparison of those two rigs, Kenwood TS590, which I believe is the more modern one, a little bit more expensive. I think I've seen one of those in operation over a friend's house. I believe it's got a nice large rectangular liquid crystal screen with lots of information on it, fancy digital signal processing and roughing filters and whatever inside. But apparently, from what you say, Rich, it only goes up to 6 meters. And you're a guy that's also going to want 2 meters and 440. As opposed to the Kenwood 2000, I'm not sure, but I'm going to guess the Kenwood 2000 has been around for like 8 years or so. So it's established a pretty good record with people. And the nice thing about the Kenwood 2000 is that you buy the right plugins and that'll go up to every one of those bands from 160 to 450. I believe there's also a 1296 module you can put in there. So anybody who knows the comparison between these two, as Rich is saying, let me drop the more modern rig, the 590, is a few bucks more. And so he's asking, but it doesn't go as high in frequency, so to speak, unless maybe there's other aftermarket or whatever modules you can put into it. So anybody who knows a comparison of those, mean time between repairs or price of repair, reliability, ease of use, user friendliness, ease of getting to those bands, anybody's got any comparisons, or if you've only owned one of them and you've fallen in love with it or hate it, in either case, tell us about it. So anybody with information on the Kenwood TS590 or the 2000, give me a call with us right now. K2RIW in the TechNet. I'm going to make a guess, Rich. Lots of guys went to the ham convention today in Levittown, and with all those eyeball contacts they had with all their friends and running around all those tables and buying all that stuff, they're now tired and bedded down. We may have a light attendance tonight. You may have to ask your question again next week. So I'm going to pass it back to you, Rich. Drag your feet just in case somebody else came along with some information on either the Kenwood 590, TS590, or the 2000. And to EO to take it with some delay. K2RI to be in the TechNet. Okay, I think that was John. Was that you, John?
Yes, Nick.
And I believe you've owned at least one of those rigs, if not both of them. So go right ahead, John.
Yes, Dick, I've spoken to Richie about it. I have three of them, Dick. I have one of the X models, which has the 1296, and two of the regular 2000s. And I'm very happy with them, very satisfied, and never had any problems. I know Hal doesn't like them, but I have been very happy with them, and I recommend it. But I'm not sure. I don't know the 590. I don't know anything about it. So back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
Please, Ian. Very fine, so you're happy with them. I know that Wes has owned a 2000, and I believe the transmit-receive relay has given him some grief on 2 meters, where periodically it doesn't put out full power. I think someone has told me that that little relay in there is not full size, and as such, maybe it's being overrated a little bit, and the contacts in the relay maybe have got to be cleaned periodically. So let's see what Wes has got to say, because I think he owns a 2000. N2XJN, K2RIW. Go ahead, Wes.
Yeah, I have two of them. One is mobile version with the portable display, and the other one is the black version, the universal one. Looks pretty nice. It's a beauty. Now, both of them suffered with the same problem, which is the relay, transmit-receive relay. I bought a few relays to have a spare one, and I managed to repair one, which is not a big deal, but you have to take half of a radio out. The whole board that is on the top, the rear of it, with all of the connectors for all of the bands, that you have to take out. And then from the other side you have relay. I mean, relay is on the top, but you have to unfold it. And I found that although it's an extremely good radio, the mobile version is extremely convenient at home. You don't have a bulky radio, they have to face that radio and see what you have on it. You can place a small display. It has a stand on it, you could put on a desk. You can place it anywhere you want it, you can move it, and you have no problem. It works. Right now I'm talking from this radio. 100 watts on 2 meters, no problem. 100 watts on 70 centimeters. No, I believe 50 watts on 70 centimeters. Other than that, 6 meters and all of the HF is 100 watts. That's sufficiently enough. And to it's here.
Thank you for that information. Now, the mobile version, what's the full model number of the mobile version, Wes? N2XJN, K2RIW?
Ask me, I don't remember. It's 2000-something-something. When you put mobile version in the Google, you're going to have it. This thing doesn't have any front face. It does have one button, power button on the front, and that's it. I was having this radio in the car, but it's bulky, and I got fed up with being distracted. Anyhow, it's not for me, I have too many other hobbies. Anyhow, this is what I suggest. Not the radio with the display, you have to sit in front of it, and you have to be able to operate it. So whatever you want to change, you have to change your position. As if you're sitting comfortably in a chair, and you want to put the display on the shelf, that's fine. You can put it on the floor, no problem. You can put it any position on the table, no problem. Well, that's the real beauty of it. And to appreciate.
Yeah, thank you for that, Wes. I think it was you, John, that said that Hal K60PZ is not so happy with the Kenwood 2000. And I'm guessing it's this relay reliability problem. Some people have the problem, some people do not. And from what Wes is saying, it sounds like the replacement of the relay is not super simple. Sounds to me like it's a medium serious surgery. Have I misquoted you, John? And was it you that told me that Hal's not so happy with it? KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
You're correct, Dick. Yeah, I've spoken to Hal about it. He doesn't appreciate that radio. too many errors and too many problems that he's seen. You know, he does a lot of that. But as far as replacing that relay, it's really not that difficult. You know, anybody with any technical skills who have worked on radios before would have no problem at all changing that relay. It's really relatively simple. But like I said, I like them. I'm happy with them. They're reasonable, and they're very effective. And by the way, the AM is only 25 watts.
Which is exactly the way it should be. If your radio can put out 100 watts peak envelope power, and you really want clean amplitude modulation, because the amplitude modulation has a peak to average ratio that's, I think, 4 to 1, it means that the average carrier power in the AM mode is going to be 25 watts. There are people with solid-state amplifiers that push the daylights out of that. And so they're compressing like crazy and making splatter, but well-made rated. Now, if I understand correctly, John, you own two of them right now. And by the way, I think by way of a friend I've got, you're possibly going to be owning a third one and maybe even a fourth one, if you so desire. It sounds to me like some people have the relay reliability problem. Maybe you never did, or maybe you replaced the relay and you found it very simple. And once the relay is replaced, does the problem go away? Was it a bad run of relays? What's your guess on that one, John? KC2WGB, K2RIW, on the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Right now I have three, Dick, and all of them are performing well. Yes, I've helped someone change relays. There were two of them. One of the relays, we put in a more beefy relay. And because he likes to run 100 watts constantly, and it takes its toll on the relay. But it was not that hard to change, for me anyway. We had a fairly easy time. But Hal just doesn't like it because it has a failure that he considers too high in many areas. So, but I like them. And sure, four or five of them, that's all right.
And we have to calibrate Hal a little bit from my point of view. Because Hal is known to do quite a bit of service on a whole lot of different radios. He's seeing the bad side of it. I mean, you talk to a policeman who's always handling domestic violence situations, and he'll tell you everybody that's married is unhappy. Well, that's not necessarily true. He just happens to be seeing the bad side of society. And Hal in the repair business is seeing all the ones that are broken. And he doesn't see all the ones that are flying very smoothly, so to speak. So, therefore, even though Hal doesn't like it, maybe it's not a bad rig. And, my guess is somebody has got a website that keeps track of the track record, reliability record of the Kenwood 2000. And if the 590 has been around long enough, maybe people have established a record on it. Very similar to what happens with automobiles. If you're going to buy a Toyota model so-and-so automobile, there's a website you can go to find out how many people are happy, and how often has it had to be repaired, and how expensive are the repairs, and so on. What's the reliability of that particular automobile? So I guarantee somebody out there is collecting reliability data on Kenwood 2000s and Kenwood 590s. So when we find that, I guess we'll bring that information to you if you haven't already done that Google search, Rich. N2EO, drag your feet a little bit in case somebody wants to add something else. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Quick note, Dick.
Go ahead, John.
Hal always says, he always recommends, if you're going to buy a 2000, make sure you buy the ARRL insurance. He says that's very important. So that's just one thing he recommends all the time.
Now, give me a couple of words on that, John. Roughly how expensive is the ARRL insurance? Is that protecting you from theft, droppage, radio failure, relay burn-up? How expensive is that insurance? What kind of things is it protecting? And do you really come out ahead? It reminds me of when I bought a set of speakers for my computer at Best Buy, and they tried to sell me an extended warranty. I mean, those speakers are the simplest circuit in the world. It's a loudspeaker with a simple audio amplifier. And for me to buy an extended warranty that's 50% of the price of the speaker system would be quite a waste. So I hope the ARRL insurance with reference to a Kenwood electronic failure
doesn't fall into that category. What's your opinion, John? KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. I think Rich knows more about it than I do. It's not expensive, and they do cover theft. But, in fact, I think Rich had insurance on some of his stuff, N2EO. So, he may know more, Dick.
So, for a whole bunch of reasons, it's coming back to you, Rich. Looks like we haven't gotten the answer for you that you're looking for. But I think we're kind of light on attendance tonight because of that great big flea market wearing people out. And a little bit later on, I'm going to ask you guys, what did you buy and how well did you enjoy it? And do you have any suggestions for any ways of changing things in the future with reference to the flea market today in Levittown Hall? I'm calling it flea market. I guess it's called Hammerama or Ham Conference. Call it what you like. It wasn't the Ham Radio University, but you know what I mean. N2EO with a little bit of delay. K2RIW the TechNet.
K2RIW, TechNet Weimark, N2EO. Very good. Well, as far as the insurance, I don't know. My understanding is it protects you from, like, lightning damage, theft, that sort of thing. I don't think it covers, maybe I'm wrong, but I don't think it covers things like what you guys are talking about is what I would call normal wear and tear. You'd have to look and see if there's an exclusion for that or not. I doubt it covers normal wear and tear. But anyway, I'm really betwixt on which radio to get. I think they're all good. But maybe I'll get it here next week. I got time to think. And the 590 has roofing filters. How important they are, I don't know. Back to net.
Mike Ralph.
Barry recognized, going to hit you in a second. It is my guess that the roofing filter, which primarily gives you high dynamic range in a strong signal environment, it's one of the main benefits of a roofing filter. If you're in a field day operation where there's a whole lot of high power radios all within 300 feet of each other, all blasting away, you not only want a roofing filter, you want a high quality roofing filter. So in your particular environment there in Massapequa, where the nearest ham with high power equipment is 5 miles away, and he's not going to be on the air the exact time you are, that's not necessarily a big requirement for you, is my guess. Now, Barry, I bet you know friends who've got both of these rigs. I bet you've got some opinions on all of the above. And to Meatball, Moon Bounce, Mike Bravo, you got it, Barry, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Magic Box, yes. I own the 2000. I've never known anybody that owned the other one, but my feelings are this. The other radio, the 590 I think it's called, under certain conditions probably will outperform the 2000. The thing is, how important is that? With some people, if you're a contester, it might be important. I don't know. But I have found, and I think Richie might agree with me on this, over the years, if the signal is that weak and that hard to receive, maybe it's just not that important. That's kind of the way I feel about it. I'm sorry, K2RW and 2MB.
Very fine, Barry. So, any further fills that you need from Barry? N2EO, K2RIW.
Okay, fine, Dick. Well, I'm really betwixt. We'll have to see. It would be nice if I could get the ham radio outlet in Delaware, but I've got too many medical problems to go down there. They're just over the Delaware Memorial Bridge. It would be wonderful. They probably have them both set up. But with that, I'm going to get out of here, and we'll just have to take pot luck.
Rich, I've got one quick question for you. If I give you a URL of a particular website that has a beautiful scientific YouTube video, very well done YouTube video by Veritasium, this genius of a scientist from Australia who's made 100 YouTube videos, all of them are very good. If I tell you that website and mail you an address, a URL, would you be able to, with your current computing equipment, be able to go to that website and view that video? N2EO, K2LAW.
I can, Dick. Could you possibly email me the URL, if that's possible? It's N2EO, HamOp, N2EO, HAMOP, at yahoo.com.
Okay, N2EO, HamOp, HAMOP, at yahoo.com. So, N2EO and HamOp, that's run together. Rich, go ahead.
That's right, Dick. All run together, yes. And, you know, my situation, losing a leg, and I've got a multitude of other problems. So getting down to Ham Radio Outlet in Delaware would not be too easy for me. But that would be the best thing.
Now, I will admit that there's a YouTube video that I'd like you to visit, which I think you're going to enjoy. Very well done. It's on a different subject than these radios. But it's on nuclear radiation. This guy ran around to all of the hot spots in the world, like Fukushima and Nagasaki and Hiroshima and Chernobyl and so on. He went to all of these hot spots where a nuclear event took place with his Geiger counter. Also flew up in an airplane. Beautiful what he did. And you'll get a kick out of it. Okay. I think we've gone down a list of everyone who signed in who said they had a question or a comment. And it's time to go over to the mailbag. And so what kind of tough questions have those young scientists given us, young and old scientists given us tonight, today, this last week? Here we go, John. KC2WGB. Our mailman, K2LAW. You got it, John.
KC2WGB. Yes, light week this week. I guess because of the ham fest and the things that were going on. Don't know, but we got a few questions. I have one about an HT. All right. This young gentleman has bought a couple of those Bofangs, and he wants to know, people are telling him that he has to add a rat tail to it to get better distances. Maybe you could explain what that is to him. It's, you know, for the counterpoise, and explain to him whether or not you think he needs it. Back to you, Deb. KC2WGB.
I am guessing that this could be a controversial area. There have been shootouts that people have attempted to do with handy talkies, and I've seen a few of them. And if you've done enough antenna testing on an outdoor antenna range or in an indoor anechoic chamber to do antenna performance testing, you realize that people who try to do a handy talkie shootout can easily fall into a trap that gives them false data. Let me explain that. You'd like to believe that the brand name A, B, and C of handy talkie with brand name C, D, and E of rubber duck on it and other kinds of antennas like extended 5/8 wave. You can buy a whip antenna that'll almost break off the connector on the output of your handy talkie, but you can buy a whip antenna that's real tall and you can put it on your handy talkie. And so people try to do a shootout, and when they do that, they'll have some kind of a receiving setup. Let me pick a number, maybe 10 or 15 feet away, maybe even closer, and the guy is holding a handy talkie. And so you're comparing handy talkies and you're comparing antennas and you're looking at the signal strength. What's happening in that environment is that you assume that the signal is flowing directly from the handy talkie to the receiving setup, which has some kind of a signal strength meter, a power meter, a microvolt meter, or a volts per meter indicator, power flux density indicator. There's various ways you can build the receiving system and quantify its results. The average guy usually does it with just the signal strength meter, and he'd like to believe the signal strength meter, that S5 to S6 is really one S unit, which is a 2-to-1 voltage ratio, which is 6 dB in power. And there he's starting off extremely naive, because signal strength meters are very nonlinear and very poorly calibrated. Let me drop. Yeah, out at the low end, there are signal strength meters where the difference between S1 and S2 is supposed to be 6 dB, and it's 1.5 dB. And the difference between S8 and S9 is supposed to be 6 dB, and it might be 15 dB, if you know what I mean. They're very nonlinear and very far from the original definition of a signal strength meter. A definition of a signal strength meter is S9. S9 is supposed to be 50 microvolts. S8 is supposed to be 25 microvolts. S7 is supposed to be 12.5 microvolts, and so on, all the way down. And you actually put a real signal generator into any particular receiver and run it up and down and look at the signal strength meter and draw yourself a graph, and you'll say, wow, it's not even close. Let me drop. So just quantifying the results becomes spooky. You'd like to believe the signal is flowing from the handy-talkie to the receiving equipment. It ain't. It's flowing through a million other paths simultaneously. And I'm only half kidding when I say a million. A major portion of that signal is reflecting off the floor. Some of it's reflecting off the wall. Some of it's reflecting off the ceiling. Some of it's reflecting off the other equipment that's in the room with you. The nice thing about radio is that once you transmit a radio signal, it goes to every cubic centimeter of this universe. You can't stop it from doing that. It gets inside of that shielded structure. It gets inside of your screen room, inside of your anechoic chamber. That's on the outside, the inside. It goes everywhere. It gets very weak in certain circumstances because of what you and I call blockage. We think that we put a metal wall between you and that receiving site, and the receiver says there's nothing there. Well, the receiver didn't go above threshold. It didn't break the squelch. But if you have the right kind of instrumentation, you will measure a signal. The signal never goes to zero. It gets damn weak at times, but with the right kind of radiometry equipment, with the right kind of radiometry equipment, with the right kind of low emitter search equipment, there's various ways that you can measure the signal strength, even though the signal is 10, 20, and in some cases of radio astronomy, they're measuring signals that are 30 dB below the noise of the receiver. The average ham will say, hey, the signal's down to the noise, it's gone. Well, not to a person who's serious about radio astronomy. He can measure that signal. And whether the signal is a noisy signal from a star or a coherent signal coming from a frequency synthesized transmitter, in either case, he can measure that signal 20 or 30 dB below the noise. So you'll find out the signal never goes to zero. But what I'm getting at is that minor changes in the altitude at which you hold the handy-talkie.
Repeater, time out.
A minor change in the altitude of which you hold the handy-talkie makes the signal that flows by the direct path versus the signal that flows from the ground mounts path go in and out of phase with each other. If you had a real good display back at the guy holding the handy-talkie, if he had a real good display, and the way we do it sometimes with a very precise outdoor antenna range, which is sometimes set up by the microwave operators, as a microwave update, they'll set up an outdoor antenna range to really measure the quality of the popular VHF antennas, UHF antennas, and they almost always find out the best performing antennas are the ones that are homebrew. Rarely does a commercially made antenna even come up to the performance the manufacturer is claiming. And so many of them are fibbing so strong for so many years that for at least a decade that I know about, QST will not allow you to put an antenna advertisement in their magazine where you claim some number of decibels of gain. You'll notice that all the advertisements, the gain number is not there, because they soon discovered that all the manufacturers of antennas are not measuring the gain in an antenna measuring laboratory. The gain is set by the advertising department. What can we get away with? Because you know that people are looking at dollars per dB and they can decide as to which antenna they're going to buy. And so they've been fibbing through their teeth. And when it comes to lying through their teeth, when it comes to television aerials, my goodness, are they fibbing also? Because almost nobody takes a television aerial into a measurement laboratory and really confirms the gain on each one of those channels. Let me drop. And many of them will display an antenna pattern, which sometimes is a real antenna pattern, and they also claim a number of decibels of gain. And if you understand antenna theory, and you look at the 3 dB beamwidth, and you look at the side lobe levels and the front to back level on the antenna pattern they presented, and then you look at the gain number that they're claiming, They're way beyond the laws of physics. You can't get there without changing the value of pi. So, a guy who's doing a shootout with a handy talkie, and he puts some kind of a doodad on it, or he puts a great big tall whip antenna on it, a so-called 5/8 gain antenna, and now he measures a different amount of signal strength, he says, aha, I'm getting more gain. Well, not necessarily. When he puts that 5/8 wave antenna on there, the center of radiation has just been raised to a higher altitude. Therefore, the phase angle of the signal that's direct versus the bounce signal may go from in phase to out of phase or vice versa. You get a great big amplitude change on that measurement procedure, but that's a very non-pure procedure. So people can put various dongles and things like that on an antenna, the so-called rat tail, where you think you're getting a better counterpoise. In reality, you're changing the apparent altitude of the center of radiation of that transmitting system, and you'll measure a different signal strength, but now you've got to be careful about how you interpret it. The bottom line of all this jazz is that as long as you're using non-lossy materials of an antenna, let me drop it. And one of the best examples I can give, one of the most extreme examples, is you take your 80-meter full half-wave dipole, usually built on a 14-gauge wire, and it's 132 feet long. And your backyard ain't big enough. And you got enough smarts. For whatever reason, you build an antenna not 132 feet long, you build it 32 feet long. You've subtracted 100 feet from that half-wave dipole. It ain't a half-wave dipole anymore. It's not even a quarter-wave dipole. But as long as you've got the right kind of an impedance-matching device at the antenna to bring it back down to 50 ohms non-reactive for your transmission line, and now you make a careful measurement, you'll find out the gain has only gone down 0.4 dB. And that's physics, and it's real. That infinitesimal-sized dipole has the exact same gain within 0.4 dB. You can read that on the infinitesimal dipole chapter out of Krauss's book, one of the Bibles on antennas. The book is called Antennas, 1950 McGraw-Hill, by John Krauss, W-H-A-K, the guy who is heading the electrical engineering department of Ohio University. And his book is now in the second and third edition, and he's now a silent key, by the way. So, a damn small antenna, properly impedance matched, can still give you full performance. So, in the case of that handy talkie, what really is the counterpoise for that rubber duck? It's the metal case that's on the bottom of that rubber duck antenna, and the hand wrapped around it that's holding the handy talkie. Let me drop. And so you add other doodads to it. Are you really changing the gain, the performance? I'm very skeptical. I'll admit I haven't done the experiment, but as I said, the way guys do the experiment, the way they try to do a shootout, is only subject to about 5 simultaneous errors, and I'm not kidding. So the way the average guy does a shootout can give him much more phony data than real data. To really try to do a proper test of antenna performance on an outdoor antenna range, by outdoor I mean anything but an anechoic chamber. And by the way, at 144 megacycles, there are the number of anechoic chambers that have good performance at 144 megacycles is not even one handful of those chambers in the whole darn United States. The way an anechoic chamber works is, yes, those walls of those floors and walls and those pyramids of absorbing material, they're very good at absorbing, usually at frequencies above 1,000 megacycles. Let me drop. Almost every one of those chambers falls off real fast in performance as you go below 1,000 megacycles. By the time you get down to 144 megs, you're in a heap of trouble, even inside of an anechoic chamber. As such, the smart people like Dick Turin, W2IMU, among others, has a chapter in the antenna handbook. In the ARL antenna book, in one of the later chapters, which is called Transmission Lines and Antenna Performance Measurement, I think it's a dual chapter. At the end of that chapter, the Dick Turin outdoor technique, which is called the Reflective Ground Plane Antenna Range Testing Procedure, which he sort of invented. And you have to do some very unusual things. You put the source of the signal for the antenna range down on the ground, opposite of common sense. And when you do it just right, the ground reflection, instead of fighting you, is in your favor and helps you with the measurement if you know what you're doing. So people have done shootouts. They put rat tails on antennas, on handy-talkies, and they thought they saw performance improvement. I'm skeptical. I'm not positive I'm right, but I'm giving you the ingredients of why I'm skeptical. Until I see a better testing procedure where somebody has done it as a kind of a shootout, right now I'm not a believer. KC2WGB, K2RIW, the TechNet.
Question.
KC2WGB. Very good, Dick. I have one thing that backs up your theory. Let me lift her up. Made a very simple test last year on a wooden ladder, which the walkie-talkie was out in the driveway. And we had a field strength meter in the lab here and a network analyzer. And we would look at the transmission when somebody was holding it in their hand, and we would get a certain result. When it was placed on the ladder, the power indication was lower. When we put a rat tail on it, it did increase it slightly. So, yeah, if there's no hand, the rat tail may help. That's what I found. And I think the increase with the rat tail was only like 1.5 dB. But that sort of backs up what you're saying, Dick. Back to you, KC2WGB.
Yeah, Wes recognized, Mike. Another question for you. You did it with the anti-talkie on the ladder with a rat tail, and in the human hand. Did you ever do it in the human hand with a rat tail? Over to you, John.
No, Dick, because I was looking for the effect of the rat tail, but yeah, that would be another good thing to try. I'm sorry I missed that. And by the way, it was it exactly the same height for each test that I maintained the height of the ladder when it was in the hand or on the ladder. So the height was the same, the distance from the detecting elements were exactly the same. But no, not with the rat tail in the hand.
Now, I got a slightly silly sounding question here, John. 99% of the time when a human being uses a handy-talkie, it is inside of a human hand. When you put the handy-talkie, probably with a rubber band around it, to push the torque lever, and you put it on a wooden ladder, that's an interesting test. But human beings don't use it that way. 99% of the time, they don't do it that way. So, with or without the rat tail, with the human being, since that's the way the radio is almost always used, would have been an interesting test. But even that, you got to worry about the fact that the rat tail hanging down below the handy-talkie is lowering the phase center of the emission, which makes the ground reflection versus the direct path go in or out of phase a different way. And so, unless you've done something to account for the ground reflected signal, it's hard to believe the measurement. The good news is that you had instrumentation calibrated, traceable to the bureau, which measures exact decibels and milliwatts of power. Your lab equipment, that's the good news. The bad news, though, Mother Nature is still doing her best to screw up your testing because of ground reflection off the trees and everything else. Over to you, John. K2IIW.
Yeah, that was true. It was just like a shot-in-the-dark type of test. The reason this test was performed, this particular walkie-talkie had a FOX system, so it would either hang on the mirror or sit on the dash, and without the hand on it, he wanted to know what was going on, and does he need a counterpoise, should he attach it to the car. It was that type of setup. So it was just a quick investigation, but we did find a little difference with the rat tail, and I expected to see more, but it was only 1.5 dB, Dick.
Comment?
Yeah, we got Wes and Comment in that order. We got Wes and Comment in that order, but there's another thing going on here, John. If the manufacturer of the handy-talkie did a good job, and he realizes that the average size hand and the average size arm is normally going to be holding the handy-talkie during its service, he therefore did an impedance match under that environment. You remove the hand, you remove the arm, the so-called counterpoise, which is now the metal case of the radio that's below the rubber duck antenna, that's now a slightly different impedance, which the transmitter was not adjusted for. you give me that handy-talky with the right kind of remote testing equipment, I can readjust the final stage of that transmitter so that without the human hand there, it now is a better impedance match. Even though the counterpoise, the case, is the wrong size, doesn't make a half-wave dipole, and it's an off-center fed dipole, doesn't matter. The magic of radio is you resonate first, then you can radiate. Let me drop. But when you change the impedance, both reactive and resistive component of the handy-talkie, because you remove the hand and arm that normally holds it, you've now got a slightly mismatched impedance of antenna. That's not the service it was designed for. However, you allow me to readjust the impedance match and resonance of that final stage of that transmitter. I will come back to the exact same amount of gain. The hard thing to believe is because you've got the antenna too small, you think you've lowered its effective capture area, and you think you've lowered its gain. Good common sense. Dead wrong. As long as the structure doing the radiating has low loss components, where it's not taking your valuable RF energy and turning it into heat, as long as it properly resonates and impedance matched, the antenna can be big, small, large, whatever. The antenna could be a chunk of wire bit in the name of your in the form of your initials of your name. As long as it resonates and it's a low loss material, it will give you full performance. You only get more gain if you really put in significant real estate. A horn antenna or a parabolic dish antenna gives you more gain because it is a significant number of wavelengths in diameter or length. Let me drop. Gain comes from real estate. If you're less than a half wavelength in outer dimensions of the antenna, as long as you do a proper impedance match, every one of those antennas will have exactly the same gain within 4/10 of a dB. And the 4/10 of a dB is not an efficiency difference. It's just that the figure eight pattern at the dipole becomes a little fatter when you make the dipole infinitesimal. So, as you can see, there's a lot going on here. Wes, you had a question on this. And 2XJN, K2LIW.
You have mentioned about the gain of the antenna and the restriction to manufacturers. My question. I have fitted a network analyzer that goes to 6 GHz, and I have ST1, ST12, ST2, the analog, and conversion coefficients, and then I can operate in logarithmic phase, delay, Smith chart, polar, linear, SWR, and plenty of things. I could have a real, imagine I could have the electrical delay and all of the stuff possible. What is that I cannot do for the antenna measurement? And to issue.
Hey, you're into a good area here, Wes. You've got a lot of capability in that instrumentation, and if it's applied to the right problem, you can perform some magic, in my opinion. By way of an extremely well-calibrated Rohde & Schwarz network analyzer, just one simple piece of equipment, and because all of the antennas I was building for this particular client in my consulting service, he needed a whole host of antennas all at 915 megacycle region. So I set up an antenna range that was exactly 3 feet long. It ran between my desk and my conference table, and a bunch of anechoic material was scattered around the room to get rid of the floor reflections. For that particular environment, where we were testing antennas that had a near-field range of like 2 feet, and the range was 3 feet long, and we only needed forward gain, I didn't care about the pattern, it just had to have a certain minimum forward gain, and an extremely low standing wave ratio across the frequency region of 902 to 928. I'm talking about no more than 1.05 or maybe maximum 1.1 standing wave ratio across that frequency region. Let me drop. You could say that's a very narrow band, very narrow view service of antenna testing. But in that environment, an extremely simple looking antenna range did magic. And the bottom line of all that was, my name is on 30 antenna patent applications. None of them have been turned down, and to date, something like 26 or 27 of them have been honored by the patent office. And what did I do? Nothing magic. It was pure ham radio, non-commercial service, so to speak. I set up the vector network analyzer with two displays. The yellow display was the standing wave ratio. The display was frequency left to right from roughly 850 to 950 megahertz. But I only cared about the region 902 to 928. So I'm scanning across the frequency region, horizontal is frequency on an XY plot, and vertical was two separate axes. The left-hand axis was VSWR, standing wave ratio. The right-hand axis was gain. The gain curve was plotted on there with a blue trace. The VSWR curve was a yellow trace. And so with these simple tuning tools, pieces of copper tape on the end of a wooden stick, held near the elements of the antenna, and I'm watching the display and feel in real time. Let me drop it. I did whatever is required. Added little pieces of copper tape, took them off, cut them, cut the things in various directions. I could do 10 different antenna experiments in a day easily by watching the screen as I'm waving the tools near the antenna and watching whether the gain goes up and down, whether or not the VSWR goes up and down. I was continuously doing the simultaneous tuning to make sure that across that frequency region, I was pushing the yellow curve down, that makes the VSWR real good, and pushing the blue curve up, that made the gain real good. The gain had to be 6.02 dB or better, and I put a grease pencil mark across the top of the screen as to where 6 dB of gain was. So I'm doing whatever is required by simple empirical testing to push the blue curve up and the yellow curve down. That's the way to really, in my opinion, get tremendous performance out of a vector network analyzer. It's allowing you to see both things simultaneously in real time. The sweep on the screen was sweeping there 30 times per second. There was no flicker. As I wiggled my hand, fast, slow, or whatever, the display was real time, VSWR and gain simultaneously. That allowed me to come up with those antenna designs, and some of those antenna designs were very fat elements made out of pieces of copper tape on a piece of vellum. That was the Holdon experimental antenna, and you now take the best antenna modeling programs that I know of, High Frequency Structure Simulator and CST Microwave Studio. You take each of those antenna programs, and you have somebody who is very skilled at using those programs, plug in those particular antennas, all the parameters that we could measure, and the program couldn't quite predict the performance I was getting. At first, we thought something funny is going on with the vector network analyzer. It wasn't real because the best respected computer modeling programs said you're crazy. The test is that the antenna is pretty good, but not that good, is what the programs were saying. The programs were...
Repeater, timeout.
The computer modeling programs were telling you that you were in the parking lot, but not necessarily into the ballpark, and they certainly weren't telling you you were at home plate, if you know what I mean. They told you, yeah, you're in the region of a good antenna, but it ain't that good. That's what the programs were saying. But the network analyzer was saying, fantastic. That's a patentable antenna. And at first we thought, well, maybe Rodin Schwartz is lying to us. So we went over to the Hewlett-Packard or Agilent, and we went over to Avantech. And all three vector network analyzers gave the same answer. And then we hooked the antenna into the real environment, which is a RFID reader. And the RFID reader was giving us performance like we had never seen before. That antenna was real. So the experimental way of deriving antennas of a broadband frequency coverage, very low VSWR, and reasonable gain, these were three-element Yagi antennas. With quite a few of the antennas. There were some other kinds, patch antennas and even a non-patch antenna. But what I'm getting at is a vector network analyzer properly used is an extremely good tool for making antenna performance measurements or antenna performance improvements of an antenna. You can slowly walk that antenna into better and better in performance, even though you can't see those waves, you can't feel it, you can't taste it. It's like a blind man walking up a hill. The tilt of his feet tells him when he's going uphill. By me watching that blue curve go up and the yellow curve go down, I knew when I was walking up the hill the right way to get better performance out of that antenna. You've got the instrumentation that if that was your desire to build those kind of antennas, you can do that. And the whole science and art, let me drop it. The whole science and art of antenna testing is not taught in any school that I know of in a reasonable way. There are lots of people who call it a black art.